Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic, our dive into the baseball cards of our youth as we look back at some great and often not so great cards from days of long ago. And in fact, this time around, we are going back 30 years ago to 1988. We take our medicine. We will be opening up a couple of packs, actually, maybe more than a couple. Based on our feverish poll of which 1988 packs we should open up, we will be going through plenty of junk wax later on in the program. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in. Got a whole lot going on today. We've got the pack breaks from the 1988 selection. We'll do that. Talk a little bit about some of the 88 cards that were out in the market 30 years ago, the effect that those cards have on the hobby and hobbyist since. Also, do you chew the gum? That was an interesting discussion that opened up on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. So we'll discuss that too. We got a whole lot here, and we'll get to your comments on Wax and Gum Stains in just a moment. But first, as always, a brief bit of housekeeping. If you didn't listen to last week's podcast, shame on you. But just want to let you know that we're going to be mixing in a few things over the next few episodes. We've got some guests coming up. And in fact, next week we'll have a guest. I'll tell you who that is in just a few minutes. Actually ties into our discussion of 1988 baseball cards here. And it's a very unique guest, a unique angle on the hobby. So we'll have some guests. And we won't be stuck in the junk wax era. We'll be going back in time to the 1940s and 50s. I've finally had some time to sort through the handful of vintage baseball cards that I bought at a flea market a couple weeks ago. So they fill some holes in my collection prior to my visit to that flea market and the baseball card show that was going on there. I did not have any cards from 1955, 56, or 1953 and prior. Well, that has changed. So we will go through a selection of some of those cards. I don't want to do it like we did in past episodes where we did, you know, year by year. So we may lump together the Bowman cards in one show, maybe put a focus on the 55s and 56 in one show, the 52s and 53s in another. So we'll be mixing those in along with our pack breaks. And we've had a lot of fun ever since the program got back online a few weeks ago. And we certainly hope to keep going not only through the summer, but if things work out right for me in my busy work-life balance, we'll keep this podcast coming your way every noon or every Friday at noon. And if you haven't already, please let everybody know that Wax Ecstatic is back, and we are posting new episodes Fridays at noon Eastern, along with video links to the pack breaks. And when it comes to the programs where I'm looking at the older cards, we'll do a video link as well and just kind of take a focus on some of those cards. So it's coming your way. iTunes, also iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, basically anyone who has a podcast platform, it's out there. With the exception of Google Podcasting, I've tried to get that set up through Google. Unfortunately, Google makes it a little too complicated. So my apologies if you've been trying to get it through Google and can't do it. But the good news is it's pretty much out there everywhere else. By the way, if you listen on iTunes, please like the show, comment on it, give us as many stars as you think you can, and help get the word out that way. That's how the algorithm on iTunes works. If you rate the shows, if you rate the podcast itself and make some comments, it gets moved up the ladder just a little bit, and it's always helpful in promoting the program. Lastly, if you want to help the program financially, you can do so with a donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, the proceeds that are raised through that go right back into the program, not only for the production cost of hosting our program and the archive on audioboom.com, but also for purchasing of packs and cards. So a lot of this stuff goes right back in. It's the tree of life, basically, on Wax Ecstatic. So paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you've already donated, thank you very much. If you got a couple extra bucks just laying around and you would like to send it our way, we greatly appreciate it. Again, it doesn't go right into my pocket. I do not get rich off of this podcast. Trust me, I do not get rich doing this, but it's a labor of love. I enjoy doing it and glad to get the program back on over the last few weeks, and certainly looking to keep going strong throughout the summer and hopefully beyond. Now, as for today's show, four packs from 1988. And I warned you about this last week. I said, we're going to take our medicine here. We're going to open up some cards from a time period that a lot of people don't like in the hobby. 1988 was not a very good year for the hobby for numerous reasons, which we will get into in just a little bit. But back on Monday, I posted the poll. I said, all right, make your choice. We've got an 88 score rack pack, an 88 Fleer cello pack, an 88 Top cello pack, and an 88 Donruss rack pack. And the way our Twitter poll goes, you select one, and the top two vote getters get opened up on the program. So we had a very interesting poll this week because 88 Fleer eventually took the lead in the race. It's a 24-hour poll, and it's amazing how the lead changes. 88 Fleer came out of the gate pretty strong, eventually pulled away, and that's not a surprise, of those four sets from that year. Fleer is probably the most popular one, even though, in my opinion, it's not the best set that Fleer put out. And even in my opinion, it's not the best set of 1988. But no surprise, 88 Fleer leads the way. No surprise, 88 Donruss did not give or get much love. 88 Donruss, all right, I got to step back here for a second. 88 Donruss is the Mr. Goodbar of baseball cards. And you know Mr. Goodbar. You buy that bag of Hershey's Minis typically around Halloween, maybe Easter, or you're somebody who just needs to have a bowl of candy around the house or the office. You get the Hershey's Minis. You've got the Hershey Bar. You've got Hershey Special Dark. You've got Crackle. And then you've got Mr. Goodbar, which is so named because Milton Hershey didn't want a chocolate bar with peanuts bearing his name. So he wouldn't put Hershey on it. He put Goodbar on it. And Mr. Goodbar is not that bad of a chocolate bar. I actually like it. I've always had a little bit of sympathy for the lesser known, least liked, pieces from bigger groups. So I like to call 88 Donruss the Mr. Goodbar because it's actually pretty good, but it just doesn't get the respect that it deserves. Much along the lines of Shemp Howard of the Three Stooges or Sammy Hagar of Van Halen. If you want to keep the music thing going, George Harrison of the Beatles, everyone loved John and Paul. But George Harrison, I mean, he's the guy who really grew and progressed the most. No disrespect to Ringo Starr. But it's the Mr. Goodbar of the bunch here. And 88 Donruss, I'm telling you, just take another look at it. Never mind the flimsy cardboard status. Never mind the fact that it doesn't have very good rookies. And never mind that it's become the poster child of the junk wax era. It's not a bad set, okay? It really isn't. For more on 88 Donruss, visit our archives, episode 25. In fact, for more on all of the 1988 sets, listen to episodes 24 through 27 as we look back at score, Donruss, Fleer, and Tops in that order. So getting back to the poll, Fleer is leading the way. Donruss is not getting much respect. And there is a neck-and-neck race between the Tops and the score packs. And with about an hour left in the poll, I saw that Tops and score were tied. I'm thinking, well, we can't do that. So I retweeted the poll. I said, hey, you know, we got to break the tie. And we get a few more votes in under the wire. And it moved the vote a little bit. But in the end, we ended up with a tie for second place. Fleer wins the vote with 36%. Donruss, 14% vote getter. But Tops and Score each get 25%. So now I'm looking at this and I go, well, what do we do? You know, I'm not going to have a runoff vote. You know, I'm not going to have game 163 here. So because these are packs from 1988, and I'm going to save you the trouble of going out and buying your own, we will actually open up three packs on today's show. A lot of cards to go through. So 88 Fleer, our winner. We will open that last, and we will go through Score and Tops and look back at a few of the players as well. Now, as for the 1988 card selection, like I said, it really stirs the passion in collectors. Some collectors, especially if you were a little older in 1988, if you were late teens, early 20s, and you had been collecting baseball cards for, you know, 10, 12 years, something like that, 1988 was the end for you. Once Score came in, okay, there's a fourth company offering cards. The designs weren't good. The rookie class wasn't that great. And everybody is buying into this hobby. It's turning into a business. It turned you off. And if it didn't turn you off in 1988, certainly by 1989 it did, because then you had Bowman come in, you had Upper Deck come in, and the hobby just becomes a free-for-all. And thus, the quote-unquote junk wax era gets underway. So I can understand why some people don't like the 1988 sets. Then if you were a little younger in that era, such as myself, this was the beginning of the hobby slash industry. So this is right in your wheelhouse. These were the cards that you saved up your money for. And now you can buy for a mere four packs at a dollar, depending on what store or flea market you go to. So, you know, 88 stirs the passions. Most people in general do not like the 88 sets, and understandably why. However, you typically have one set you really love or you really hate. And that was reflected in your comments on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Let me give you a sampling. Dub Mentality. 88 was a rough year, in my opinion. Score was good, and Fleer had a solid design. But the year is forgettable in many ways. It's sandwiched between the iconic 87 top set and the intro of Upper Deck. Right on the head. You hit the nail right there, Dub Mentality. That's something I've discussed in the previous episodes on the 1988 sets. One reason why we don't like the 88 sets so much, not only is there not much of a return on investment of the value in cards, if you're looking at it from a business standpoint, but with hindsight being 2020, you know, baseball cards had such a great run in the mid-80s. And I've said this before, for Topps, Fleer, and Donruss, if you go from 83 to 87, you have some iconic cards. You've got some great designs. You've got, you know, again, from a business sense, you've got a, you know, pretty good value in a lot of that cardboard. And then 1988 comes along. It's a bump in the road, isn't it? And 1989 comes around, and of course, Upper Deck changes the game. The other card companies, for the most part, raise the level of their quality. You know, Topps had a pretty good set in 89. Donruss and Fleer had decent sets in 89. Never mind about Score and Bowman. That's another story. But, you know, looking back 30 years ago, you can clearly see that the 88 sets were just an outlier. Didn't quite live up to the hype from 1987 and beyond, and then what would ultimately come around in 1989, and, you know, by extension, the changes in the hobby in 1990 and 1991. Velvet Jones says, loved 88 Fleer. Banner Season says, Score was the worst ever, but Cello kind of sucked too. Waxpack 916 selected 88 Donruss in our poll. Reminds me of those elementary school portraits with laser backgrounds. Oh, man, you are right on the target there. In fact, while I was reading that, I was laughing because I had one of those laser background elementary school pictures. When I was in the sixth grade, that would have been the 1988-89 school year. And that was the year that I had the laser background photograph. And that was also the year that I was at my fattest, chubbiest, buzz-cuttiest time in my life. I did not like middle school that much, now that I look back on it. But the only other way it could have reflected an Olin Mills portrait, 88 Donruss, is if they added that ghost-like profile angle up in the corner. That would have been something. Ben Adams comes to the defense of 88 Donruss. I still like 88 Donruss. Nobody can change my mind. Meanwhile, Korean Cardboard says, easily fleer than score. 88 Donruss, worst of the decade, followed by 88 Tops. And to that I challenged, worse than 82 Fleer? I don't think so. You know, 88 Donruss is not well loved, but 82 Fleer is an absolute clunker. And then, of course, you've got 89 Bowman, which I like, but a lot of collectors don't. And some of the premier editions of Fleer and Donruss were not that good in 1981. But, you know, everybody has an opinion there. 88 Tops I've never been a huge fan of. However, I've started coming around to it. True story, about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I bought a lot of vending boxes on eBay. It was one of those sellers who had, it was a box of 87, 88, 89, 90, 91. And, you know, with shipping, it came out to like $45, pretty decent deal. And I opened up all of the boxes except 88 Tops. That one just kind of went to the back of the shelf in the closet. And a few months ago, I think I was just bored one day, and I thought, you know, I should just open up that 88 Tops box. Why the hell not? And I opened it up, and I don't know, maybe it was because it was, you know, case fresh, you know, as fresh as a 30-year-old item can be. Or, I don't know, maybe just the printing run was right. The colors were vibrant. The cards were, you know, not all caked in gum and wax. But I kind of looked at it and went, these are actually pretty decent cards. And now it's being added to my collection of junk wax sets that I'm trying to complete, which, you know, started many years ago. When I was a kid, I would complete the 87 Tops set and sell it. And I'm like four cards away from completing the 87 Tops set. And one day, a few years ago, I realized, you know, I got a bunch of 1990 Tops just kind of laying around here. Here, let me put that set together. Okay, I'm, 100 cards short or whatever. And then one day I went, you know, I'm just a few cards short of completing 91 Tops. Maybe I should try that. And then, you know, I got that vending box of 89 Tops, and I really regretted throwing out so many of my 89 Tops cards. So I went, you know, I'm going to build that set. And now I've got 88 going. And, oh, by the way, 86 has reared its ugly head. I'm going to try to complete that. So the beauty of the quote-unquote junk wax era is that if you suddenly find yourself rebuilding sets from that era, the cards are rather cheap to come by. It's not that hard to complete a set. Not that you're going to sell it for a ton of money, but simply because you've, you know, done something by completing a 792 card set. A couple more thoughts about the 88 set. Let's go to Baseball and More. Great comment here. And Baseball and More posts a picture of the 88 score George Brett. And it's Brett with his eye on the ball. I mean, just right prior to, I don't think he's going to swing at this because it's entering the batter's box and the bat's still on his shoulder. So he's taking this pitch. But looks like he's at Exhibition Stadium in Toronto, and he's got his eye on the ball. It's great action shot and framed very well. One of the things I loved about 88 score was the framing of the photographs. And in fact, it actually looks like you're looking through a camera lens, the way that they designed the card, the little white box inside the outer border. And Baseball and More comments, innovator with photo quality cards led to 89 Upper Deck and Stadium Club cards. The George Brett was my favorite, plus a simple, minimalist design. And that's where I think, I believe 88 Score was actually the best set from that year. And I know Fleer fans will argue with me on that. But so many things that 88 Score did right. And as I mentioned in the earlier podcast on 88 Score, that was episode 24 with Mike LaValle as our selected card, 88 Score did a lot of things way before Upper Deck did. And that includes better photography, minimalist design, full color photos on the back, tamper resistant packaging. You know, there were a lot of things that Score did way before Upper Deck did. But Upper Deck gets all the credit because Score eventually died on the vine, and Upper Deck, you know, raised the bar throughout the entire hobby. And in fact, Booby Main, Robbie T86 checking in, 89 Upper Deck's biggest innovation was doubling the price of a pack of cards. If Ken Griffey Jr. had debuted a year earlier, 89 Upper Deck would be just another pile on junk wax heap. Wow. I don't know if I would go that far. However, you do make a good point in the sense that timing is everything. And had the Ken Griffey Jr. debut, the fact that Upper Deck made Jr. card number one of its set, and of course now basically photoshopped the Griffey card because he wasn't a member of the Seattle Mariners. He was actually further on down the line in the Mariners organization with the Belleville Mariners. Belleville's in Ontario. Bellevue, Washington, was where Ken Griffey Jr. was playing at the time. Had they not doctored the photograph and got that legendary picture of Griffey, who knows if Upper Deck, if they would have gone to the heights that they would have, because that Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. race for many years drove the hobby. So, some interesting points. I won't quite go to the extreme you did, but, interesting observation there. Finally, KevmoK21, great comment here. Would love to hear on the podcast the history of Score, who they were and where they came from and why they failed while Upper Deck succeeded. That would be an interesting solo podcast, if you will. I will say this. Let me give you the short answer, which you can listen to a little more in episode 55, which was our focus on 92 Score, featuring Jim Tomei, recent Hall of Fame inductee. One of the big reasons why Score flailed while Upper Deck succeeded is because of the ripple effect of Upper Deck. So Upper Deck comes around in 1989, raises the bar. Finally, in 1991, Top Stadium Club comes around, raises the bar even more. And after 1991, there's no more simple baseball card set. Everybody improves their card stock, has some kind of glossiness to their cards, has limited editions, breaks up the sets into series, has chase cards and variations. And what happened was when everybody else raised their game, and then you had the offshoot premium edition. So you had Top Stadium Club. You had Leaf, which of course was the owner of Donruss, but Leaf then became a premium edition card. The same with Fleer Ultra. So, you had all of these really nice limited run premium edition sets come out. Well, Score was owned by the Pinnacle Company. Ah, Pinnacle. Remember that name? Yeah, Pinnacle became one of those card companies, or brands, I should say, that tried to be premium. And Pinnacle made the conscious decision in, I think, 1992 to basically make that premium card the base set of the company. And Score was just left on the vine to die. And, it wasn't just that fateful decision by Pinnacle Company. Of course, Pinnacle and Score would go by the wayside just a few years later. But the Pinnacle cards, while leading the way and leaving Score out to dry, You know, Score was putting itself in that position for many years. The 89 set was not that good. It's one of the worst in the decade, in my opinion. Score had to bounce back in 1990, so they're playing catch up. In 1991, they tried to do the bigger is better game. The 1991 Score set was a whopping 905 cards, which is just too big. And when you add a 905 card set and the fact that there were literally millions of each individual card printed, it's all part of the oversaturation, the bloating, the flooding of the market. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. Score just got too big, too fast. And when you get too big, too fast, you can't maneuver, you can't be nimble. And with the Pinnacle decision in 1992, it just got too big, too fast, too bloated, and basically popped. It was a Mr. Creosote of cards. So that's the brief explanation of what happened with Score. Upper Deck made a few more strategic and sensible decisions along the way. Although Upper Deck in Major League Baseball would eventually meet its ultimate fate. But, Kev, for more on Score, our guest next week, a gentleman named Michael Chapman, somebody who got in touch with me a while back, actually I think when we did the original 88 Score show. Mike Chapman is a high school social studies teacher in Massachusetts. And when he first reached out to me a while back, he made it be known that his father worked for Score when Score was just starting. And prior to the launch of Score, his dad was working for the Topps Baseball Card Company. So we're going to be talking to Mike on next week's show on what it's like growing up in the house where dad is not only collecting the baseball cards, but selling them. And, you know, I don't mean this in the, you know, he owned a local card shop. I mean, the guy was part of the baseball card company, which to me is neat because we all respect our dads or love our dads for various reasons. But, you know, I think if you had a dad who was basically in charge of the hobby that you were involved with and all of your friends in the neighborhood were involved with, that is a really cool thing. So I'm looking forward to that conversation with Michael Chapman next week on the program. One last comment from PK Steinberg, listening finally to the reemergence of Wax Ecstatic. Our Kuntz is a little rusty after the break. Of course, that was the comeback episode from a few weeks ago. Great to have you back on board, PK, and great to have everybody back on board as well. Now, before we open up the cards, one of the things that was also discussed on Wax and Gum Stains this past week came from just this innocent posting from Tred Willis, who also put up a poll. So I picked up some old Wax C comments, what should I do? And I was tagged on this poll, and I saw the picture, and it's a collection of probably about, 16 or so packs. Few 88 Donruss, few 88 Tops, few 90 Tops, few 90 Upper Deck. And the poll options were break them all, break some, your choice, or save for another 30 years. Well, I selected break them all because, you know, from the standpoint of financial gain, even though the hobby's having a little bit of a revolution here and it's starting to revive itself a little bit, and there is also a revival of junk wax collection from my generation, your generation too. We're buying these cards we used to buy as kids. You know, you're not going to be able to store a box of 88 Tops away and sell it for $50 anytime soon. It's going to take you 20 or 30 years. And even then, you know, unless warehouses of former card shop owners burn to the ground, there's just going to be millions of these cards out there. So from a financial standpoint, I don't know. You could sit on it if you want to. I don't think that's where the money's going to be short or long term. So in my opinion, you probably spent, $6 on those packs, all of them, seven maybe. Open them up. It's harmless fun, you know. So just spend an hour opening up, looking through them, you know, pull aside the handful that are still somewhat valuable. And by that, I mean like a dollar or more. There's a few of those cards out there from those sets. And one of the comments on that thread came from Nick, who says, "Break them all and chew the gum." To which Cliff replied, "Chew the gum is a given." And then the Kosh says, "It's a rite of passage. If you open old packs with gum, you must do one stick." Much to the horror of some of our fans who are following along here. And I said, okay, we've got to discuss this briefly on the show. And I do say briefly because we got a lot of cards to get to here. But common sense tells you, don't chew the gum. I mean, really, it's a 30-year-old piece of gum. We all know the consistency. We all know you can snap it between your fingers. That's not normal for a stick of gum. We all know even when it was fresh 30 years ago, it wasn't that good. And still, we wonder, should we chew the gum? Now, if I opened up a 30-year-old jar of peanut butter and just scooped out some of the contents inside and just gave it to you and said, here, eat this. You're probably not going to. At least I don't think so. Common sense tells you, don't chew the gum. Then again, common sense told you, don't touch the stove. And don't elect the reality TV star into public office. But still, we do strange things, don't we? We wonder if we should chew the gum. Now, for those of you going, oh, I would just look horrible if I ate the gum. What will my friends think of me if I chewed the gum? First of all, you're a grown man collecting baseball cards. You don't care what people think about you. Let's be honest. We're a bunch of fat nerds, okay? We gave up on trying to impress people years ago. And if people are impressed by what we do or who we are, it's because of what we do or who we are and not necessarily our hobbies. So, you know, the whole idea of being publicly shamed by admitting, you know, you might chew on an old stick of gum, just stop. Yeah, you gave up on your self-conscious years ago. And you've made it this far, so just keep it going, okay? I will say this. I normally don't chew the gum because, again, common sense tells you, don't eat the 30-year-old piece of food. 30-year scotch? Yes, please. Neat. Thanks. 30-year-old gum? Nah. But it brings us back to our childhood, doesn't it? Yes, you wanted the cards, but the gum, well, that was a nice bonus, even if it was a little stiff. So I'll admit, every now and then, I'll chew it. But I won't allow it to get into my stomach. I will not eat the gum. I'll chew it, but I don't eat it. Now, if you know anything about human anatomy, you also know that the digestion process starts in your mouth with saliva and also the glands in your mouth and blood vessels. You know, you start intaking nutrients as soon as you put something in your mouth. So I don't know what chemical trades are being made when I merely chew on the gum, but I'm sure it's not pleasant. But every now and then, I'll put one stick in and just kind of let it dissolve. If you don't do that, or if you haven't done that, the best way I can describe it is it tastes like Pepto-Bismol, which if you've had to take Pepto-Bismol, it's not a pleasant experience. Unlike Pepto-Bismol, the old gum does not help your digestive tract. It may have the same after effect of pooping things that come out in strange colors, but it's not a very pleasurable experience. But if you have to do it, my advice is just take one piece, put it in your mouth, just kind of let it dissolve. Don't chew on it because then it gets stuck in your teeth. But, you know, put it in your mouth, Let it dissolve. Get that Pepto-Bismol taste that you've long desired to have. And then just spit it out. That's the best I can say. I would not swallow the gum. I would not digest it. I don't even want to know how it can wreck your digestive system. Probably not any worse than a basket of fried cheese curds at the county fair. But, you know, this is more of a common sense decision. Again, you're at the county fair. Hey, I'm at the county fair. Let me have some deep fried grease. And you buy it, you eat it, you regret it. But, you know, you're in the moment. 30-year-old food, however, again, common sense tells you don't do it. But if you have to do it, just do it carefully. And let's carefully open up these packs because we got a lot of cardboard to look at here. All right, so we have our packs here, all four of them. What an exciting vote. And you kids, you're so cool. 88 Donruss only getting 14% of the vote. Still some pretty nice cards here. So we'll set that aside for another time. But we've got our leader in the clubhouse, Fleer, with Matty Noakes on the front. And because we had a two-way tie for second place, each getting 25% of the vote, we will open up both the 88 Tops and 88 Score. And I'm going to open up 88 Score first. It is a rack pack, because there's a lot of debate, as we already discussed, about the merits of Score. First of all, just in 1988, but also just in the hobby in general. And you can already see the tamper-resistant packaging taking effect here. It's not a clean cut from top to bottom. But let's open up these shelves and see what we've got here. Eric Davis. I love that photo of Eric Davis. I mean, this is a guy who's about to hit the ball 300 miles. So we lead off with him. Speaking of Matt Noakes, I love this card too, because it's just framed perfectly. And of course, you've got the frame design here with 88 Score anyways. But it just looks like he's about 4'2", and he's got an 8-foot tall bat. It's very dramatic, actually. Mark Langston with the Seattle Mariners. Of course, he would get a lot more fame as being one of the trade pieces in the Randy Johnson deal to Montreal, and would later star with the California Angels. Scott Bradley, longtime catcher for the Mariners. Bedrock, Steve Bedrosian in the beautiful powder blue road unis for the Phillies. Ken Caminiti, that's a rookie card there. That's a nice one. The late Ken Caminiti with the Houston Astros. Great power slugger. Speaking of another great rookie card here, Paul O'Neill, although we got a little printing error here, a little line running right down the side there, and it affects the side of the pack too, just a little bit, or side of the card, as you can see a little bit of white. But a nice find there. There's Al Pedrick, the late Alan Wiggins. Boy, what a sad tale he was. We'll talk more about him later. Mike Scott, one of the more underrated starting pitchers in the 1980s, paired next to one of the greatest pitchers in the 1980s. Talk about another troubled life. The Dr. Dwight Gooden. Butch Weingar, then with the Angels. Davey Lopes with the Astros. A lot of people forget that he was winding down his career in Houston. Of course, a longtime member of the LA Dodgers, but bounced around a little bit after that. Mike Loind of the Texas Rangers. We've got Joel Youngblood of the San Francisco Giants. Nolan Ryan in his Houston Astros uni. That, of course, would be the last year that he was pitching in Houston, and Jeffrey Leonard with the Giants. Now, before I get into the second pack there, as you could see, the motion, kind of that sports flicks motion card. This was the premium that was thrown into Score packs back then. Great moments in baseball. And you have, do you remember Fenway Park, April 29th, 1986, of course, the 20 strikeout game for Roger Clemens against the Mariners. Now, we've got Matt Noakes again. Unfortunately, a little bit of a ding to the upper corner here, but this was another premium that you saw in the Score Rack Packs in 1988, the Young Superstar. And it was a subset, a 40-card subset. Like I said, rather unfortunate you got the little ding there, but a little glossier, and actually looked not only more like your regular baseball card at the time, but also had a little touch of 89 Score, mainly the color scheme, the blue and the green with the white borders. Mike Stanley of the Texas Rangers, again, another beautifully framed shot here where you get him in full swing against the Baltimore Orioles. Looks like a spring training game there. Mike Socha, then the catcher of the Dodgers, longtime catcher for the Dodgers, now the manager of the Angels. Mike Boddicker of the Orioles. We've got Brett Butler when he was with Cleveland. Brian Fisher of the Pirates. Kurt Young of the A's. Here's your magic motion card again. Jim Gott of the Pirates. Scotty McGregor of the Orioles. Mike Fitzgerald of the Expos. We've got Barry Lyons of the Mets. Mike Young running full speed ahead with the Orioles. Jeff Kunkel, another great baseball name from the 80s. Jeff Kunkel of the Texas Rangers. Rich Dotson of the White Sox. Pete Incaviglia with the Rangers. A Reggie Jackson bonus card here. So here's a highlight of Reggie in his days with the Oakland Athletics. Although I'd have to look back at unit first. I believe this is a Kansas City Athletic cap that he's wearing. So this may be spring training in 1967, perhaps. But anyways, this was a special card that was part of the base set. A salute to Reggie Jackson, as he had retired at the end of the 1987 season. Doug Jones of the Indians and Bill Buckner living his life of infamy here with the California Angels, of course, wrapping up his career just a few layers, I believe, in Kansas City. And then we've got, from our last pack, we've got Steve Sachs, one of the most underrated characters from Homer at the Bat. Rick Sutcliffe, we talked about him in our last podcast. Seagull killer Dave Winfield, we got Eddie Whitson of the Padres. Bob Walk of the Pirates. Mike Pagliarulo of the Yankees. Another magic motion card, Tony Phillips of the A's. Tito, Terry Francona with Cincinnati. We got Randy Bush, another one of those names where if you were a teenager in the 80s, you just kind of giggled at it. Put it next to your Rusty Kuntz and Pete Lecocq cards. Lenny Dykstra, who, by the way, looks absolutely terrible nowadays. Shane Raleigh. Ken Griffey Sr. Yeah, we wouldn't have the Ken Griffey Jr. rush until 1989. Steve Ontiveros of the A's. We've got Sean Dunston, utility infielder extraordinaire. Donnie Hill of the White Sox. Jamie Quirk of the Kansas City Royals. And then Kenny Schramm of the Indians. All right, let's get to the Topps pack real quickly. And again, I have a whole new respect for Topps, not necessarily the gum, but I will leave it up to you if you wish to chew on this magnificent crumbling piece of drywall. And the gum is stuck somewhere else in here. Here we go, on the Topps store card, which is offering the Glossy All-Stars and Hot Prospects set this time around. All right, we started off with Tony La Russa, the dreaded manager card, even if he was doing magnificent things with the A's back then. Tom, Don't Call Me Michael Bolton. Donnie Moore, the late Donnie Moore of the California Angels. Dave Magadan of the Mets. We've got Mike Jackson of the Phillies. Bob Welch of the Dodgers. The dreaded checklist card, although, as I've said before, I will take a checklist over a manager card any day. John Davis of the Royals. We've got Brooke Jacoby. Another flash from the past, name from the 80s, very underrated third baseman. Kevin Gross of the Phillies. Bob Ojeda of the Mets. We've got Devon White, not a rookie card, but they put the rookie cup on his card. His rookie card for Topps came in the 1987 set. Very underrated player. We'll talk about him in a little bit. Bob Boone in the twilight of his career with the Angels. We've got Albert Hall. And every time I hear Albert Hall, I think of the Beatles. Let's see, we've got Rob Brower of the Rangers, another great 80s baseball name, Cecilio Guante. I mean, is there anybody else whose last name sounds like bat poop? You know, we've got buckets of Cecilio Guante out in the loading dock. Gary Gaetti of the Twins, Fred Manrique, who looks like Bob from Bob's Burgers here with the Chicago White Sox, Joe Sampito of the Red Sox, Eric King of the Tigers, Floyd Rafer of the Baltimore Orioles, and his catching mate, Terry Kennedy, next to each other. Steve Shields, not the Buffalo Sabres goaltender, with the Seattle Mariners. Cal Daniels of the Reds. Jamie Quirk, again with the Royals. Terry Poole of the Astros. We've got Ellis Burks, much like Devon White, getting the rookie cup treatment, although his rookie card in Topps came in 1987. and the big man, time to make the donuts, Steve Balboni of the Royals. And last but not least, we've got the number one vote getter in this poll, 88 Fleer. We've got a lot of fans of 88 Fleer. We've got Matt Noakes up top, but first, we've got to kind of look at the stickers that come in here. Texas Rangers. I love the baseball holding look that they had with their stickers back then. And I love the 88 Fleer stickers because they had pictures of the stadiums on the back. And remember, in 1988, a time before the internet, unless you went to a stadium, this was the only way you could see what the other teams' ballparks look like. So this is a great view of the largest frying pan in Texas, the old Arlington Stadium. Then you've got the combo stickers here, the smaller Yankees and Padres sticker. And they did a picture with the Mets. What the hell is that? You got Yankees and Padres, you put Shea Stadium on the back? Come on. Bring back the Murph. All right, there's Matt Noakes, the late Tony Gwynn, another spectacular card. Awesome Jerry Curl going on there. Cal Ripken Jr., so we've got another all-star here right off the bat. Mike Marshall of the Dodgers. Eck, looking pretty fierce. Dennis Eckersley, or looking like he just toweled off at the beach. Floyd Yeomans, we've talked a little bit about him in some past episodes. Mark Gubiza of the Royals, looking very concerned about something in that shot. We've got the dual major prospect card, Greg Myers and Greg Tabor. Now, Myers, of course, would have a much lengthier career, but this is certainly not one of the top prospect cards of the set. Edwin Correa of the Rangers. David Cone, good old Coney. We'll talk about him in a little bit there with the Mets. I love that old Mets road uniform from 1987 there. Greg Minton of the Angels. One of my favorite goofy cards of the 88 Fleer set, Kent Tekulve, just looking like an absolute doofus on this card. Masters of the Double Play, Ozzie Smith and Ryan Sandberg. This was part of the base set, but Fleer used to stack the back end of the base set with special cards like that. We have Jose Oquendo of the Cardinals, Chris Bosio of the Milwaukee Brewers before he got in a lot of trouble more recently. Charlie Pulleo of the Atlanta Braves. What's interesting here is you have the new Braves uniform for 1987. They were still using that logo in 1988. I think they finally phased it out in 89. Bill Ripken. No, not the great 89 Fleer card, but we've got the brothers Ripken in this pack. Billy Doran of the Houston Astros. Bill Wilkinson of the Mariners, John Tudor of the Cardinals. We've got Dave Bergman of the Tigers, Daryl Miller of the Angels. Another Bob Brower card. We're hitting the Bob Brower sweepstakes in this podcast. Kevin Mitchell, third base for the Giants. Of course, you would know him better as an outfielder for much of his career. Cliff Young for the A's. Look at that gigantic A on his jersey there. I think he got the last one at the bottom of the stack when that picture was taken. Keith Comstock of the Padres. We've got Todd Benzinger with the Red Sox, better known for his time with Cincinnati a couple years later when they won a World Series. And Barry Lyons of the New York Mets. So a lot to discuss about. Let's get back and pick out some of these particular cards from this cardboard stack of glory we just went through. All right, so many cards to look through here. Let's go through a few of them, starting with the score set. Matt Noakes, again, I love that picture. That's a great picture. You know, Matt Noakes, Tigers fans remember him, but he had a hell of a rookie season in 1987. The only problem was so did Mark McGwire. So he was a runner-up in the American League Rookie of the Year running. But Matt Noakes, underrated power-hitting catcher, only had about two or three years of great baseball in him. But you may not know he once landed an airplane, a small passenger plane that had some mechanical problems, landed it on a highway back in his playing days. I want to say a few years after this card came out, 1990 maybe, 91. Mark Langston, again, a very underrated pitcher, had a great career mostly with the Angels, was part of the 98 Padres World Series team that lost to the Yankees, and of course will always be remembered as part of the trade that the Montreal Expos made, giving up Randy Johnson to Seattle and worse yet for the Expos, they didn't re-sign Langston after that trade in 1989. He walked as a free agent and then signed with California. Let's see. Ken Caminiti, such a sad story. Great talent, best known for his offensive output, but one of the best defensive third basemen of his time. Gold glove winner. I think he won, I want to say, 3 gold gloves. Battled alcohol and cocaine, died after speedball. Sad, way too young, too. Way too young. How old was he? He was, I think, about 30, 31 years old. Paul O'Neill, we did a podcast on, let me see, what set was that Paul O'Neill card? 90 Bowman was Paul O'Neill. Episode 36. I've got a great story about the day Paul O'Neill was traded from the Reds to the Yankees. One of the math teachers at my high school, Mr. Burnham, who's been dealing with some medical issues recently. I wish you the best, Coach Bruce. But he was a big Reds fan and not a fan of the trade of Paul O'Neill. Alan Wiggins, kind of in the line of Ken Caminiti, the late Alan Wiggins, very talented infielder, very speedy guy too, stole a ton of bases when he was with the Padres in the early 80s. Unfortunately, did more than steal bases, also addicted to drugs, cocaine habit, if I remember correctly, eventually contracted AIDS through sharing dirty needles for the various drugs that he used, and he died a long time ago, 1990 or 91. And I remember reading his story in Reader's Digest, of all things, when I was a kid. Very tragic story there. Mike Scott, the 1986 National League Cy Young Award winner, clinched the National League West title that year for the Astros by no-hitting the Giants. That's quite the way to seal the deal there. A guy who often gets overlooked, the Astros outside of 1986, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, not a very good team. Of course, Nolan Ryan was the better-known pitcher, and he's in this pack of cards as well, but often overlooked, an incredible split-finger fastball. A student of Roger Craig's pitching coaching, and had his number 33 retired by Houston a while back. Dwight Gooden, speaking of fireballers and Mets draft picks, a lot of people forget that Mike Scott was originally a member of the New York Mets, but Dr. K, as he was known, I love this picture too. This is well after he's delivered the pitch, but that look in Dwight Gooden's eyes, that struck fear in the hearts of men. Dwight Gooden, even though he was not stocky, you know, Nolan Ryan would strike the fear of God in you because he was such a big guy. Ryan was 6'2", 210, and he just had that mean piss and vinegar Texas look in him. Dwight Gooden, listed at 6'3", 198, so a little lankier. But he had that look in his eyes, and he could just blast a fastball right past you. Of course, Dwight Gooden's issues off the field are well known, and quite honestly, it's amazing he's alive right now, although he's been in the spotlight after that 30 for 30 with Daryl Strawberry a couple years ago. Even Straw's been worried about Dwight Gooden. Gooden, a product of the Tampa baseball machine of the late 70s and early 80s, West Tampa Little League, cranked out so many great players. Gary Sheffield, Floyd Yeomans, of course. Let's see, who else? Dave Magadan, Fred McGriff, Tino Martinez, Jody Reed. So many incredible ball players that came out during that time. Jeff Kunkel, other than having a great name, the son of umpire Bill Kunkel, very well-known umpire from the 1950s and 60s. A funny note here on his Wikipedia biography that I love. It says, Kunkel reached the big leagues quickly but never developed into a full-time player. The Rangers gave him the opportunity to win the starting shortstop position, but he was always thwarted. Love that word. Thwarted by his hitting stats, and obstacles such as Curtis Wilkerson, Scott Fletcher, Fred Mamrick, Gary Green, and Jeff Hewson. Now, Jeff Kunkel played far more Major League Baseball games than I ever did. But if the obstacles in your career are Curtis Wilkerson, Scott Fletcher, Fred Mamrick, Gary Green, and Jeff Hewson, perhaps you should prepare yourself for another line of work. I looked at the Reggie Jackson card here. This is actually a picture from 1968. The Oakland A's, back then the cap just had the letter A. It wasn't A apostrophe S. I don't think they had that hat until 1970, I want to say. The A look was popular in the early years in Kansas City and a long time in Philadelphia, but that tied me up just a little bit. I've noticed Keith Olbermann pointing out that there's only, I think, three pictures in existence of Reggie wearing anything that is Kansas City associated. Of course, he was in the Kansas City organization for only about a year and a half, but wasn't really seen as a key part of the major league team then. He was working his way up through the minors and then, you know, breaks onto the scene in Oakland in 1968. Speaking of Oakland, as we shift to the 88 top set here, Tony La Russa, another product of the Tampa baseball machine, not of the 70s and 80s, but of the 1950s. He was part of a West Tampa baseball group that traveled to Cuba in the 1950s before the Castro regime came in. And he was also a graduate of USF and, of course, very storied career as a manager. Took him a little while, starting out with the White Sox, but got the White Sox to the postseason in 1983, of course, a lot of success with Oakland and later St. Louis. Speaking of Tampa baseball machine, there's Dave Magadan right there, a key cog of some of the decent Mets teams of the late 1980s. Back to the tragedy, Donnie Moore, his story very well known, and I believe it was page 2 of ESPN.com a while back did a feature on the last days of Donnie Moore. If you Google it, it is well worth your time. Brooke Jacoby of the Indians, one of the half-decent players the Indians had back in the late 80s, along with Joe Carter and Corey Snyder. Greg Swindell was another one of the half-decent players, and after that it was a lot of flotsam and jetsam. But Brooke Jacoby, who is now the hitting coach for the Toronto Blue Jays, part of the trade package that sent himself and Brett Butler and a couple other players to Cleveland for Len Barker, a trade that the Atlanta Braves surely regret. Bob Ojeda, member of the 86 Mets. Every time I see Bob Ojeda, I think of that awful boating accident he was involved with in 1993 with Tim Cruz and Steve Olin that killed Cruz and Olin. Ojeda had some major injuries from that, but he was able to recover and play a few more years in the big leagues and went on to a broadcasting career too. Devon White, you know, I loved Devon White as a Toronto Blue Jays fan in the 80s and 90s. Devon White is probably the most overlooked player who was a key, consistent key contributor back in that time. You know, there's a lot of overlooked players from that team. You think of Ed Sprague, you think of Pat Tabler and Candy Maldonado, and who else there? A lot of players who were kind of marginal had their moments. Pat Borders is another one. Dwayne Ward. You know, there's a lot of little parts to the championship teams that Toronto produced, but Devon White was such a good hitter. Great defensive guy, too. Patrolled center field so well. Great leadoff guy, too. And you think back to the, 92 and 93 Jays. You think of Ricky Henderson and Paul Molitor and David Cone and Jack Morris and, of course, Dave Steeb before that. You think of Tom Hankey. But, Devon White, he was often the straw that stirred the drink. Roberto Alomar, too. How could I forget him? But such an underrated player. Bob Boone, a teammate of White's in 1988, wrapping up his career at this point in time with the Angels. He is back in Philadelphia now as he is a Washington, the assistant general manager and vice president of player development for the Nationals, and of course, a member of the rather prolific Boone family in Major League Baseball. Ray Boone, his father, had a very successful Major League career, and two of Bob's kids, Aaron and Brett Boone, had some pretty good careers. Bob Brower. Okay, we joke about hitting the Bob Brower sweepstakes here. Even though Bob Brower is not known for his baseball career, a very interesting note on the back of this card. It says, Bob attended Duke University on a football scholarship. He rushed for 130 yards in a 1979 game and was selected ACC Offensive Back of the Week. So I bet you didn't know that about Bob Brower. And I bet you also didn't know, even though he had very limited experience in Major League Baseball, in fact, he only played for about 3 years. For the last 20, he has served as the vice president of the Scott Boras Corporation. Bob Brower is doing just fine. Gary Gaetti, Twins fans love this guy. Gary Gaetti and Kent Herbeck were probably the ugliest combination of corner infielders in Major League history. These were the guys who could have been models for Big League Chew. Gaetti and Herbeck, certainly no beauty contestants. Ellis Burks, you know, we're talking about underrated outfielders. Ellis Burks not only had a pretty good few years with the Boston Red Sox, but also a very lengthy career. He retired with the Red Sox in 2004. And after he retired, he moved into the front office of the Cleveland Indians, and he's been there ever since, as a special assistant to the general manager. Steve Balboni, love Steve Balboni. He is, of course, from the Gorman Thomas, Pete Incaviglia, Dave Kingman school of baseball, where he would either crush a ball 450 feet or he would strike out 250 times in a season. But I mentioned that he was, I said, time to make the donuts. So this particular card reminds me of those Dunkin' Donuts commercials from the early 80s. All right, a few more cards from the 88 Fleer stack. I mentioned David Cohn. I love that Mets road uniform that he's wearing on this particular card. Coney, of course, Kansas City native, was drafted by the Royals but then traded to the Mets in 1987, or just before the 1987 season. And I think there are a lot of Royals fans that are wondering what could have been. You know, could they have extended that success that they had in 1985 a few more years had they kept him? That's a great shoulda, woulda, coulda question for baseball fans. But, you know, I think David Cohn was not only a key part to keeping the Mets' success going for a few more years, but of course winning a world championship with the Blue Jays in 1992, winning a Cy Young Award in Kansas City in 1994, and then talk about success, sustained success with the Yankees in the late 90s, and he's been part of the Yankee broadcast crew for a few years. Greg Minton is often overlooked. He was a halfway decent pitcher, pretty good reliever for the Giants in the early 80s. But for hobbyists, Greg Minton will always be remembered as the subject of one of the worst airbrushing in baseball card history. Of course, the 1978 Topps Greg Minton card, if you don't recall it, just look it up on Google, and you will see why I call it the Velvet Elvis of baseball cards. And that's followed up by Kent Tekulve, who we featured in our episode on 87 Fleer quite a while back. That is episode number 22, where Kent Tekulve is not looking quite the doofus that he's looking here on this 88 Fleer card, but on the 87 Fleer card, he looks like that dad photo that everybody has from some childhood vacation. Chris Bosio once pitched a no-hitter for Seattle, won a World Series as a coach with the Cubs a couple years ago, and let's just say he's had better days prior to or since then. And then finally, Kevin Mitchell, a very talented third baseman, outfielder, utility guy. You can put him anywhere. MVP winner for the National League in 1989, key reason why the Giants were in the World Series that year. And depending on whose storybook you read, quite possibly the craziest man on the face of the earth. So some very interesting cards there, not only the personalities and stories behind them, but, you know, 1988, again, it's a year that a lot of collectors don't like for various reasons, and understandably so. But as we have learned in past episodes, and one thing that I've really stuck with, you know, in the two or so years I've been doing this podcast, one great thing about looking back at some of these cards is you start getting a little bit of a different perspective of the cards. The cards you used to really hate, once you really look at them, and I mean really look at them, and you hold them again, you know, you open the packs again, you hold them again, you look at them again, you realize, you know, maybe they weren't quite as bad as they seemed, or they're not quite as bad as some people make them out to be. And that's, again, my plea for hobbyists to just take a quick look at 88 Donruss again, the Mr. Goodbar of baseball cards, the Shemp Howard, the Sammy Hagar, the George Harrison. You know, take a look at it. It's not a very valuable set. There's not a lot of great rookies. You know, Roberto Alomar is the big one in that year. That year, I should say. But, you know, take another look at it. Same with 88 Tops and 88 Score. You know, I think a lot of people like 88 Fleer. It wasn't one of my favorites, but it's not a bad set. But I think if you take a good look at these sets again, like I said, you realize they're not really as bad as everybody made them out to be. And like I've kind of come around on 88 Tops the last few months, maybe you will come around on one of these sets as well. And again, a lot of these cards, especially from 1988, and certainly from 88 through 93, you know, if you want to mark that as the junk wax era, they're out there. They're not extremely valuable, but they're fun to open. And I can tell you through experience, if you want to make a card shop owner or a flea market retailer of baseball cards happy, buy some junk wax off of them. They're marking it down to $3 for $1 or $4 for $1. It's cheap entertainment. And you will make a card store owner's day if you walk up to the counter with a handful. I don't mean a handful. I mean like you've got your arms cradled and the packs are about to fall out. You're walking up with like 20 cello packs, and it's going to cost you $5 stinking. And the owner's going, whew, finally got that crap off my shelf. You're helping him. You're having fun. You're not blowing your bank account. It's win-win-win. So especially with the 1988 sets, the next time you're out at your local card shop or you're at a flea market or if you're at a card show, if you're at the national show, yeah, look for it. You never know. Take home a little bit of junk wax. Make a card dealer happy. Rip open whatever you buy, and don't let the gum get into your stomach. I am your host, Matt Salmon. Once again, we will dive a little deeper into the early days of Score, as we will have a conversation with Mr. Michael Chapman, whose dad worked for Topps and Score, and also Big League Chew. That's going to be an interesting part of the conversation. So growing up with baseball cards with the man who helped make them and sell them. That'll be part of our show next week. Also, I do believe we'll have time to go through at least one pack. So look for a poll on Monday. I'll see what I've got left from the lot that I bought a few weeks ago. And we'll open up something next week. And as always, Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter 24/7. Your comments are welcome there. Questions, observations, anything about the hobby. And make sure you pass along the word about the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains to your friends. And also that Wax Ecstatic comes your way once again Fridays at noon Eastern. See you next week. Thanks for listening to Wax Ecstatic.